This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the aftermath of the shootings at Charleston's Mother Emanuel Church, then South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley decided the time was right for the removal of the Confederate flag, which had flown on the statehouse grounds for years. Many viewed that as the last shot fired in the Civil War. Apparently, it was not. The violence resulting from the recent white supremacist and neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the subsequent defacing of some Confederate memorials and the removal of others, legally and illegally, has reopened the conversation about what should be done with these vestiges of a bygone era. Proponents of keeping them say they were erected to honor ancestors who fought and died for a cause in which they believed. Those who want them gone point to these statues and monuments as in-your-face symbols of hate. I think both sides would agree they are part of our history, but does that history belong on our streets and in public parks or in museums? Would removing these symbols be like erasing our history? We're going to spend the hour talking about that. Later in the hour, we'll hear from a history professor, a camp commander of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and former State Senator Malcolm Graham, who lost his sister in the Charleston Church massacre. And we want to hear your thoughts about these symbols and what should become of them. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch this program today on Facebook Live. First, we welcome David Graham, a staff writer with The Atlantic magazine. He's based in Durham and has written extensively about recent events there surrounding these Confederate symbols, and he joins us via Skype. David, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Earlier this month, you wrote that it could be argued that despite Robert E. Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, that the American Civil War actually ended in Durham. I had never heard that. Explain that.
So the major surrender that everyone knows about was at Appomattox, but it was actually 2 weeks later in Durham, or in what would become Durham a few years later, that Joseph Johnston's much larger army surrendered to William Tecumseh Sherman, which basically ended the Civil War in the East and effectively any hopes that Jefferson Davis could sort of rally troops and come back.
Does that make the removal of a Robert E. Lee statue from the Duke University Chapel and the taking down of the statue outside of the courthouse even more significant to you?
I think it adds an interesting wrinkle to it. Both of those statues were put up, 60, 80, 70 some years after the surrender. But it adds an interesting historical wrinkle, I think.
You live in Durham. I'm not sure what word to use here, uprising of people who felt compelled to go and take it upon themselves to take down that statue in front of the courthouse. Did that move surprise you?
I think yes and no. I actually wrote back in 2016 about the sort of awkwardness of that statue and what it represented, and I know I was not the only person to notice that. Since the statue came down, I've talked to some people who said, for years I've talked to people about pulling that down. We've resented that for a long time. On the other hand, I've talked to people who said, I had no idea this was even standing here. I walked by it a million times, and it never occurred to me until it came down and I realized what it represented and I started thinking about it.
You wrote, quote, in what might seem a blunt metaphor for the fate of Confederate symbols in progressive southern cities like Durham, the statue tumbled down with barely any effort. It's been my impression that this hasn't been easy. We've been arguing about this, talking about it, arguing about it, having a disagreement about it for over a century, but most of those symbols still stand. So how is this easy?
Well, I think what's surprising is it took, in the sort of literal sense, it took so little force. These activists came and they put the strap around, and it turned out it didn't take very much to take it down. And I think there's a metaphor there. I mean, we have been talking about these statues and these symbols for a long time. There's been an ongoing debate. And what's interesting is seeing in South Carolina after the shooting at Mother Emanuel, people thought that flag would never come down, and it then very quickly did. And I think something similar here happened, where this statue seemed very permanent right up to the moment where it turned out to be barely tethered to its base.
Do you think that the reason for that is either the influx of people from outside the South into the South, or is it simply distance from the end of the Civil War and the end of Jim Crow?
I think there's a little bit of both of those. I mean, I think Durham is also an interesting case in that this is a very progressive city, not just because of transplants, but also because there's a large black population that's been here historically. That statue was erected just a block away from Paris Street, which was known as Black Wall Street in the 20s when that statue went up. So there's always been these two currents coexisting. And I think that's one reason. The people you saw at this when the statue was toppled was a real mix of people black and white and people, I think, from Durham and people not from Durham. So it's a mixed coalition.
Excuse my ignorance, but what was that statue of? Who was that statue of, the one that came down at the courthouse?
So this is just a sort of generic Confederate soldier. It said, in honor of the boys who wore the gray, and was erected by the United Daughters of the Confederacy in 1924. So it's just a sort of a standard infantryman with rifle.
Which is not unlike many of the statues that stand in courthouse squares and squares around cities around the South. The Durham County Sheriff made arrests in the aftermath of this because this was an illegal removal of this statue, and they did destroy public property. Do you have a sense that this is what the people of Durham want to see, these people arrested and prosecuted and potentially jailed?
Well, I think it's a big mix. I get a lot of sense from people who have told me, I think there needs to be some sort of consequence. This is public property. You can't just go tearing things down. But they also feel that some of the charges the sheriff is trying to push, including felony charges for rioting and inciting a riot, are a little bit stronger than necessary. And they say, this is vandalism. It's not a felony. And there are mitigating factors like the painful history and many of us think these should come down, they say. So I think people want to see some sort of repercussion, but maybe not the strongest.
Duke University took down their statue or removed their statue of Robert E. Lee from the chapel because it had been defaced, and they said, to protect other elements of the chapel from defacement and damage. And then, of course, people took it upon themselves to remove this statue from the courthouse square. Is there a passion for this, for removal of these monuments in Durham, or are these isolated incidents?
There's certainly a passion among some people. On Friday, there was a threat of a Klan rally rumored, and 2,000 or 3,000 people came out on the streets to rally against that, and they were sort of a de facto block party at the site of the statue. So there are a lot of people who are excited about it. The other thing you hear is with the there's a statue at UNC in Chapel Hill, Silent Sam, which is a Confederate monument, and there's a big movement, really, I think, around the Triangle among people who would like to see that come down now, too.
You mentioned that you talk to people who, some of whom walk past that statue every day and never noticed it, didn't know what it was of. It was just there. It's like anything else that we have in our daily lives. A lot of things we just go unnoticed. But you ran a quote in one of your stories that sums up one side of this argument's feelings about these artifacts. It said, all those years, black people had to go to court, walk past this sign, and think you were going to get justice? Who said that?
So that was a woman named Tia Wilson, who lives in Durham. And I went down when the statue came down. I had been with the protesters, and then it sort of dispersed, and I walked back to the site of the statue. And there's a group of people there, mostly, I would say, middle-aged, older black folks. And they were just sort of standing in wonder, and she was there. And she's worked on sort of community activism and working to try to improve relations between the police and people. So she's, she's not a random person, but it was really interesting to see these people watching the statue and just sort of the relief and the joy at seeing it come down. And she said, this is a symbol that represents injustice for a lot of black folks in Durham.
You also spend time in these articles writing about the disparities between black and white in Durham, and this is something that is not common and just particular to Durham. This is all over the country, all over the United States. And you write, as if it were not ridiculous enough for black taxpayers to be subsidizing the upkeep of a monument to a war fought to keep their ancestors enslaved, a statue celebrating a war fought to maintain white supremacy seemed a contradiction too painful and incongruous to remain in today's Durham. That's you speaking, I believe. Is that a widespread feeling up there?
It's hard to tell. I think there are a lot of people who feel that way. But there are also a lot of people who think that this is historical and that it ought to stay, and that there are better ways to go about correcting history, whether that's contextualizing monuments or not. I think it's a fairly progressive city, and so a lot of people are not sad to see the statue go, though. It was not a popular rallying point until it was popular for people who wanted to tear it down.
But what about the people who don't feel that way? Has there been any backlash, any comment from those folks saying we need to protect these symbols of our past because they are history?
There are those people. I think they've been fairly quiet. And part of that is, you know, just this, the political dynamic. When there are so many people literally out in the streets celebrating this sort of thing, it doesn't create a great forum for folks. On Friday, when there was this rumor of a Klan rally downtown, there were a couple guys there who said they had just been there and happened to be there when the protest came through. And there was a real a pretty tense confrontation between them and some of the protesters over whether the statues would be removed. And they said they felt like it was unnecessary and it was trying to change history. There are people who feel this way, but I would say they are they're certainly more quiet within the city of Durham.
This seems to be an unintended consequence of white supremacists feeling emboldened enough again to walk in the streets and carry torches in Charlottesville, etc. It's resulting in a backlash that is taking down the very things they want to honor. Is this just another battle in the Civil War? Is there an end to this?
I think it's hard to imagine an America where race issues are not an important cleavage. This is something we've been dealing with since before the foundation of the country. We may move past this particular monument controversy. It seems like many of them are going to come down. But certainly we're not going to heal the racial wounds this country has simply by taking down these statues, even if for many people it does go part of the way to doing that.
And Durham is just around the corner, just down the street from Raleigh, home of the General Assembly, the body that passed a law in 2015 that bars the permanent removal of historical monuments located on public property without prior state permission. Is this instance and the decision by Duke University, which was had a statue on private property, as well as comments by Governor Cooper about removing these monuments, is that liable to work toward having that law reversed or have the opposite effect with legislators digging in their heels on this issue?
I suspect it will make legislators dig in their heels, at least in the short term. And after Governor Cooper called for the repeal of that law, we saw Phil Berger come out in a long post on Facebook and explained that he did not think that should happen, that he thought it was bad history, and that, you know, the legislature passed this law for a reason. Given the relationship between the legislature and Governor Cooper, I find it hard to imagine any immediate movement. So I think we're going to see more protests and demonstrations and maybe people sort of trying to take guerrilla actions like they did in Durham.
David Graham is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's written several articles on these latest incidences in Durham, and I thank you for joining us today by Skype. Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to have a very short segment here because there are probably as many opinions about what to do about these pieces of American history as there are people, though the balance of those opinions may vary greatly depending upon where you live and your own personal connection to America's past. So for the rest of this hour, we're going to hear out some of those opinions and talk about what these symbols mean today and what they meant to people at the time they were erected, and explore how pieces of history should be treated when they conflict with modern sensibilities. Dr. David Goldfield is the UNC Charlotte Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History and Pulitzer Prize-nominated author of works like Still Fighting the Civil War and America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. Good morning. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
He's in our Spirit Square studio along with Bill Starnes, Camp Commander of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Thank you for being here.
Yes, sir.
And former North Carolina State Senator from Mecklenburg County, Malcolm Graham, who lost his sister Cynthia Hurd in the Charleston Church Massacre, is also with us. Good morning and welcome back.
Good morning.
We're going to have our conversation coming up right after the break. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com and on Facebook at Tyndall Subaru. And Charlotte Mecklenburg Stormwater Services, the deadliest place to be during a flood is in a vehicle. From behind the wheel, water levels are unknown. Don't drive through floodwater. Turn around, don't drown. Stormwater.charmec.com. Well, the halls of the Charlotte School of Law are empty. The school was forced to close after a year of constant uncertainty. Where does this leave students, some of whom are deeply in debt for their unfinished educations? We'll talk about that and what ultimately led to the school's demise, and then examine the latest shoe to drop in the series of Wells Fargo scandals, the exit of the bank's chairman, and what that means to their efforts to rebuild their image, both tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, men and friendship. By middle age, many have too little of it, and it's a threat to men's health. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. On listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're going to talk more about the fate of Confederate memorials around the country, but particularly in the South with Bill Starnes, with the Sons of Confederate Veterans, Malcolm Graham, former state senator, and Dr. David Goldfield, professor of history at UNC Charlotte. And let me start with a little history, David. You told National Geographic several years ago that the Confederate battle flag had not been flown since the Civil War, and that's the Robert E. Lee flag that we're all familiar with, until Southern politicians began using it in their campaigns after World War II. When were most of these Confederate memorials and statues that we see in public squares, when were they erected primarily?
There was a big spike from the 1890s to the 1920s, and again from the 1950s on for the next 20 or 30
years. And in that first wave, in the 1890s to the early part of the 20th century, what was the reason given by people putting these up? And many of them were put up by the Daughters of the Confederacy, and I'm sure other groups were involved as well. But what was the primary reason given at the time?
It was an education function because many of the people who fought, the generation who fought in the Civil War, were dying off, and the children were born, and they had no idea about or little idea about the war and its impact on the South and the nation. So the United Daughters of the Confederacy, primarily an educational organization, decided to commemorate the war. To erect these statues, and it became a very good fundraiser for them, and it engaged the entire community. But it also occurred at a time when the South was institutionalizing white supremacy through laws that disfranchised African Americans, laws that provided for segregation by law. And of course, during this time, between the 1890s and the 1920s and 30s, lynching spiked as well. So these statues were not only a reflection of education, but they were also a reflection of white supremacy.
But I think it's important to note that the motivation, a big part of the motivation, was to commemorate people who had fought and died, and to I guess say thank you in a way to people who were still survivors and still alive at the time. But there was this wave of white supremacy, and when these statues went up later, the later statues in the 50s and 60s, was that a kind of dig in my heels, in your face to the federal government? I'm not sure of the word to use here. A way to say we're going to hold on to our aspects of our heritage.
If you look at the use of the Confederate battle flag, it really increased after the 1940s, particularly during the Dixiecrat movement in 1948 and the 1950s. And, of course, this was a time of the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, and these artifacts from the Civil War were part of that debate. And Georgia restructured its state flag to include the Confederate battle flag in 1956. And monuments and plaques began to be erected, re-erected, and erected all over the South in the 1950s and 60s. And they were statements that we are the South, and we defy federal authority. And this is our response to it. So just as in the 1890s it was connected with white supremacy, so too in the 1950s and 60s it was connected to white power.
So can you separate the two, the desire to commemorate ancestors from this desire to say we are not going to bow to the federal government on this integration thing?
Many of the soldiers who fought for the Confederacy fought to protect their homes and families. Not necessarily to advance the system of slavery. However, the overall cause of the Confederate States of America, if you read the secession documents and if you read Alexander Stephens' cornerstone speech, slavery was at the core of the Confederate States of America.
I know, Bill Starnes, you disagree with that. You were quoted in a newspaper here as saying that the Civil War was not fought over slavery. You say it was a war about taxes. Why do you feel that way?
Based on research primarily, and that's what I base it off of.
But if you read the Articles of Secession from every single state that seceded, usually in the first paragraph of those articles, there's a mention of the fact that we're doing this to preserve the institution of slavery.
Well, bearing in mind, you know, slavery was important to the economic situation of the South at that time. But if you read those secession documents in their entirety, slavery is not the only thing that's referenced. And if you read them carefully and with the right mindset, thinking from a legalistic and a historic context, you'll find that they make a very well-stated legal argument for the southern states to secede from the Union based on so many of the northern states and the federal government's failure to meet their constitutional obligations under the Constitution. A lot of other arguments could have been made as far as the taxation and stuff like that. But the problem with that is, you know, you get into all those, get into the weeds and stuff with how the money was raised.
But if you put slavery in the first paragraph of every secession document, can you deny that slavery was part of the reason, at least if not the entire reason, at least part of the reason
for
seceding?
And I've never said it was not a part of the overall equation. But again, it was used as a very strong and solid legal context to support the southern states' legal right to secede from the Union. And the secession is not prohibited by the Constitution.
Malcolm, you want to jump in here?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting conversation, and obviously I have a personal relationship to it. My sister died at the Emmanuel AME Church, 110 Calhoun Street, Charleston, South Carolina. Statue of John C. Calhoun, literally a block away from the church being on Calhoun Street. John C. Calhoun fought for and defended Southern rights and slavery and desegregation.
You bring up something interesting. I know you grew up in Charleston.
I did.
Which is an historic city, one of the most historic cities in the country. It's certainly a Southern city. It is where the Articles of Secession were voted on in South Carolina. It's right across the harbor from Fort Sumter, where the first shots were fired in the Civil War. It's hard to get away from history in Charleston. Should we be getting away from that part of our history in Charleston, of all places?
It's everywhere. I came to Charlotte and studied political science and history because of all the history that Charleston has. History has a place. And after the massacre in Charleston, the governor as well as the General Assembly worked hard to bring the flag down. The flag was placed on top of the Capitol primarily in the 40s and the 50s as a thumb in the face to the federal government saying, hey, we're going to do it our way. And it stood until 2015. And the sad thing about it is, but for the murder of 9 individuals on that Wednesday night, that flag will still be flying today. And so I believe that based on what happened in Charleston, based on what happened in Charlottesville, these are continuing sequence of events connecting the dots.
You, Bill Starnes, I know have been quoted elsewhere, and I've seen you on television talking about this, saying that these white supremacists and people like Dylann Roof, who took the life of Malcolm Graham's sister, represent nothing that you stand for. In fact, just before we started this conversation, you reached across the desk and shook Malcolm Graham's hand and said you gave your condolences for the loss of his sister and said that Dylann Roof represents nothing that you stand for. Does that mean may be very difficult for some people, black and white, to understand because these symbols of the Confederacy have been appropriated by racists?
Yes, sir, and we struggle with that in Sons of Confederate Veterans. That's one of the biggest problems we have. If we could get those knuckleheads out of the picture, it'd make our life a whole lot easier.
But when you remove racism from the Confederate flag and from statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, etc., what are you left with?
True history. If you may recall that Stonewall Jackson taught Sunday school classes to black children, free and slave. He was very dedicated in his church, and at that time it was against the law to teach blacks to read and write, but he did that.
We had a conversation, David Goldfield, on this program with the grandson of Jefferson Davis, maybe the great-grandson of Jefferson Davis by now, I can't remember. But he alleged that Jefferson Davis was not in favor of slavery. He thought it was an institution that would cripple the country, the South particularly.
I think many slaveholders had second thoughts about the institution of slavery, and they said, well, this is what we inherited, so this is how we would go along, particularly as the rest of the world, rest of the industrialized world, began to abolish slavery. So this was a concern not only of Jefferson Davis, but of Robert E. Lee and many others. But this is the system and institution they inherited, and they felt that they had to protect it.
Following the altercation in Charlottesville, someone made the observation that in Germany there are no statues of leaders of the Third Reich. There are no symbols of Nazism. All those symbols were removed immediately following World War II. Why should we, and I'd like to hear from all of you on this, why should we permit the public memorialization in public taxpayer-funded spaces of people who fought against the United States and lost?
I think that comparing the Confederate States of America to the Third Reich is inappropriate.
Are there statues that you know of or memorializations that you know of in any country in the world of factions that fought against the state, lost, and then the state continued in its current form?
Well, I don't know that, but there are ways to deal with these statues to make history whole.
Which because we're going to talk about.
Because they only really deal with part of the history of the South.
I'd like to hear from all of you on that question.
I don't remember. We always celebrate who finished second, right? I don't know who finished second in the Super Bowl last year. No one cares that I finished second in a congressional race. Why should we put on a pedestal for those who finished second, who lost the war, and idolize their heroes? There's a place for it. It's the history books, maybe history museums,
well,
but we ought not to celebrate.
But Abraham Lincoln, the president, until he was shot in April of 1865, when the Civil War ended, he wanted conciliation. He reconciliation. He didn't want even General Grant let the Confederate soldiers who surrendered at Appomattox take their weapons with them. They didn't want to have an armed encampment. I think that only occurred because of the death of Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln had Dixie played on the White House lawn when the Civil War ended. Did that set the stage in your mind for this, Bill Starnes?
It very well could have, and there's so much history there that people need to look at. And as far as the monuments that we have to our Confederate soldiers, our ancestors here in the South, those were put up by their families, and we're talking about daughters, granddaughters, great-granddaughters, so there was a very close connection there. To honor those men who fought well and for a good cause. They were not fighting to preserve the institution of slavery. They wanted consent. They wanted to be governed and consented to govern. And that there's nothing wrong with that. Slavery wasn't part of the equation in them. It wasn't by any stretch the driving force. Had Lincoln simply recognized the state's rights to secede in 1861, just as he did in 1847 in a speech he gave then, saying that, you know, people had a right to do that, there would have been no war. Slavery would have gone away probably within a decade or two of that. The South was converting more to a manufacturing economy in conjunction with an agricultural economy. There were a lot of changes were taking place.
How big a role did Abraham Lincoln play in the start of the Civil War? It's my impression, and I could be wrong because I just read stuff. You're a historian, David. The secession began before he even took office, didn't it?
Yes, it's correct, but he definitely escalated the conflict.
His mere presence, the mere fact that he was elected president, precipitated this.
Right, because
what was it about that fact that he was elected that threatened the South so much that they met in Charleston to secede?
Well, the Republican Party, of which Abraham Lincoln was the head as president-elect of the United States, had vowed to end the carrying of slaves to the territories,
right.
to bar the slaves from the territories. And the fear was that, well, if you can bar slaves from the territories, you can bar slaves from where they are right now. Also, Lincoln was an economic nationalist, which meant that he wanted to use the federal government to subsidize transcontinental railroads. And the Republicans had posited a northern route for the transcontinental railroads. There were many economic reasons, as Bill Starnes indicated, that the Republicans wanted to reward their northern constituents and the and therefore leave the South basically in a colonial position. So there were certainly economic arguments, but at base, the issue was slavery.
There was a lot of discussion when the flag came down at the State House grounds in Columbia after the AME, after the, help me out here, Malcolm.
Church shooting.
The church shooting. And it happened in other states as well, mm-hmm. where these flags came down. Are these monuments, these Confederate monuments, as offensive to some African Americans as that flag was, because many people said it was an affront to them?
I think so, and it goes from community to community. Certainly in Charleston and South Carolina, we were dealing with the flag on the top of the Capitol for three decades, trying to bring it down. NAACP, other corporations, NCAA wouldn't do any basketball games in the state of South Carolina, championship games, that is. And I think after the church shooting in Charleston, I think people really kind of took a look at themselves in terms of these monuments, these flags that are flying on public property, public taxpayers paying for it to support that type of image.
Do you think that these monuments, the existence of them, particularly on publicly tax-funded pieces of property, give encouragement to the racist elements in our society? Unintentional, although the sons of Confederate veterans may not see it this way, does it give succor to those who are racist?
I think it does. I sat in that courtroom for 4 weeks and listened to the manifesto of Dylan Roof. He loved the Confederate flag. He visited monuments. He hailed monuments.
But he was not terribly well educated, as I understand it.
Well, you know, he was educated enough to buy a gun. And went to the church and scouted the church for 4 weeks before he committed to shooting. He was educated enough to understand the importance of Emmanuel AME Church and the significance of his history. So he wasn't dumb by any stretch of the imagination. He knew where to find the Confederate monuments to go visit, and so he embraced it. He held it and he made it his calling card.
So what to do with these? When we come back, we'll talk about that, because obviously they're part of our history and people believe if you take them down, you are erasing history. Don't want to be accused of that. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Douglas International Airport, offering information on real-time parking availability and a map designed to assist travelers with summer airport parking, cltairport.com. And SunTrust Private Wealth Management, teams of local advisors who help look beyond the portfolio, preparing clients for whatever life brings. Confidence starts here. Details at suntrust.com/reserve. The health consequences of a lack of friendship are becoming apparent. The Surgeon General says loneliness is a bigger health problem in America than cancer or heart disease, and it is particularly acute for men. That's the topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point with Tom Ashbrook. Our conversation will continue in just a moment, and you can join us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or through Twitter at charlottetalks.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Okay, let's get the view now from Spain, which is still reeling from terrorist attacks there.
It's your community. we help you understand it.
He said Charlotte School of Law intends to comply with North Carolina law by not performing post-secondary degree activity. He says for that reason, they took down the website and...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about monuments and memorials and statues that were erected in the late 1800s through the 1960s to the Civil War, to enactors, to people who involved in the Civil War, soldiers, Robert E. Lee, the leaders of the Civil War, with Dr. David Goldfield, professor of history at UNC Charlotte, author of America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation, and the book Still Fighting the Civil War. Malcolm Graham is a former state senator, and his sister Cynthia Hurd lost her life in the Charleston church shooting. Bill Starnes is commander, camp commander of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. In 1866, Robert E. Lee wrote, "I think it wiser not to keep open the sores of war." Does that say to you that he would be on the side of those who would have these memorials removed because they are keeping open the sores of war, Bill?
I don't think so. Robert E. Lee was a very fine, humble Christian man. He was a great leader. His men loved him. But he would not want a monument erected to him due to his humility, and that's based on his love of Christ, to be a humble type of person. But, you know, these wounds we speak of with these monuments, let's go back to the origins. First of all, there had to be a national threat to the institution of slavery. When I looked at my research, that is where it started. I wanted to find out what was the cause of the war. I was always heard it was slavery. I wanted to read that law or that bill or that constitutional amendment that was going to end slavery or had ended slavery in the United States all across the nation. I couldn't find it. There was no such bill. There was no such law. There wasn't anything in Congress at that time being debated to end slavery. There was the Corwin Amendment that passed the House and Senate in February and March of 1861 that prevented Congress from ever interfering with the institution of slavery. So there was no national threat to slavery.
But isn't that just like today where there are alternative facts? Not that those are alternative facts, but that people of the time refused to see those as facts and saw a threat that perhaps didn't exist?
Well,
and felt compelled to act on that?
If they were compelled to act on that, if the southern states were seceding only for slavery, when the northern-controlled United States Congress passed the Corwin Amendment prohibiting Congress from ever interfering with institutions within the states, including institutions holding people in service, here was slavery forever offered to the southern states on a silver platter. They turned it down and said, no, that's not what the problem is.
But
the problem are all these other issues.
If you have a civil war in any country...
We didn't have a civil war. There was no attempt to overthrow the existing government and replace
it. Okay. We had a war of secession, a war to divide the country between North and South, the United States of America, the Confederate States of America. The Confederate States of America lost that war and were reunited with the United States. So there was a rift, deep gash in the body politic. How do you heal that if 150 years later you still have arguments over what to do about flags and statues to the people who lost the war and the people who started that war?
Well, Lincoln started that war.
How did he start it? He didn't fire the first shot.
Yes, he did.
Did he?
Yeah, absolutely. When he sent troops and ships into the Fort Pickens in Florida.
Did he have a choice, David?
Yes, he did.
Yes, he did.
Absolutely.
Okay. It's good to know. Go ahead.
The Confederate States of America had legally and constitutionally seceded from the Union. So first of all, the Confederate States of America was its own sovereign country.
Okay.
Although it was only six states. They were sovereign. Lincoln refused to honor the armistice we had with the Buchanan administration. He sent troops to go into Fort Pickens. The captain on that ship would not land those troops because he thought it was an act of war and didn't want to be involved in it. He got direct orders from Lincoln to land them. He did that. The next night, he had a ship and troops outside the Charleston Harbor to do the same thing.
So, David, the Civil War settled the idea once and for all that you cannot secede from the Union. Prior to the Civil War, that was not the case?
That was not the case.
So would you agree with Bill Starnes that the secession of the Confederate States was legal under the Constitution at the time and our reading of the Constitution at the time? Or is that still, in your mind, an open question?
It's an open question.
Okay, let's move on to the monuments because we could talk about – this is a whole other show and it's fascinating. And we should probably learn more about this because it might enlighten us a little bit. But in a lot of small towns – these memorials are the only public works of art that stand in the public square. And the argument has been made that if you remove them, you are diminishing these towns. Are we?
No.
Why not? What's going to replace those public works? You're going to take the statue off the pedestal? What are you going to do?
Well, there are other ways you can deal with that other than removal. There are two ways, in fact. One way, what I would suggest, is to erect another statue of a slave or a slave family with chains at their feet standing next to this Confederate soldier statue. And the story...
You're contextualizing
it. Yeah, contextualizing it, that the actions of one resulted in the freedom of the other.
So is that what you do at Stone Mountain, Georgia, outside of Atlanta, where all these Confederate soldiers or leaders are carved into the mountainside? You really can't do anything about that, and you wouldn't want to. That's a piece of art.
Yeah, that is another story. That is definitely a piece of art. But I saw a wonderful display during the Olympics of 1996 when they were held in Atlanta. The closing ceremonies when they played Ode to Joy, Beethoven's Ode to, from Ninth Symphony, they superimposed a hologram of Martin Luther King Jr. on Jefferson Davis, Stonewall Jackson, and Robert E. Lee. And it was just a magnificent moment of reconciliation. The idea, you don't necessarily have to remove the statues, but contextualizing them, if that doesn't bring about reconciliation, at least it brings history whole, because these statues represent only part of Southern history and not a very accurate part.
So Kathy agrees with you. She emails, if North Carolina must keep the monuments where they are, a plaque should be added, like Holocaust Museum and other places, that decries and abhors the cause of slavery and owning humans. How do you, Bill, feel, how do your fellow sons of the Confederate veterans, how would they feel about adding a plaque or adding a statue that depicts the travesty of slavery next to these other statues?
Slavery was travesty. Robert E. Lee condemned it. Stonewall Jackson condemned it. Jefferson Davis condemned it. Many Southern people did. There was abolitionist movements in the South before the war. But again, to understand these monuments, you've got to understand the whole thing, what happened, what led to the war, what were the causes of the war, how was the war prosecuted, the fact that the Northern troops killed some 70,000 civilians in the South, men, women, children, free and slave, black and white. These atrocities happened at the hands of the Yankees, and so we still have a lot of feelings. At the time these monuments were erected, particularly then, those wounds were still very much open and bleeding. Okay. And there were, the South was still decimated from what Sherman did.
But you would not be opposed to handling this memorial situation by adding to it.
That's where I'm going. If we can see the whole picture, mm-hmm. and if everybody can understand the way that war was waged against the Southern civilians, and how many were actually killed at the hands of the Yankees, and the homes burned and looted.
The purpose of war is to kill people. That's the purpose of war.
Yes, but not civilians. Yeah. Not civilians. Not unarmed civilians. Not children. Certainly not children. These people shot kids in the head with rifles. You need to understand that. They shot unarmed children in the head with rifles and pistols. They cut their throats. They raped their mothers in front of these children, black and white. So, no, war is not to kill civilians and certainly not children.
All right.
So we've got to understand the whole concept. But, yeah, I'm about putting everything into context.
Okay. So would that work for African Americans?
I can't speak for the whole community.
Of course not. Nor can he speak for all the white people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, in many cases, some of these statues need to be placed in a museum. They ought not to be on the public square, honoring racism, discrimination, and hatred. And I disagree with some of the Christian beliefs that these guys were Christians.
I think there are 1,500 or so monuments of Confederate memorialization around the country. Could you put them all in a museum?
Well, you know, certainly museum or private property, I don't think they ought to be supported.
Even if you erect the other side of the story next to them on a public on public property?
Well, I think at some point in time, logic has to come into play. And so certainly that would be a good compromise as well.
I want to let you hear what Corrine Mack, the head of the local NAACP, had to say about these memorials.
I know some folk think that, you know, we should keep them uplifted because it's heritage and it's history. But what about the history of African Americans that have been removed from the textbooks? Nobody's talking about that. In fact, every time a black person talks about slavery, we're told, oh, that's in the past. Why don't you forget about it? Well, America needs to remember it.
She brings up an interesting point that one could assume ties to a lot of people's critical attitudes toward about Black Lives Matter. Just shut up and forget about the years of repression and mistreatment, which I've heard people say about the Black Lives Matter movement, that they want special treatment. Bill, if white people want to dismiss that and they want African Americans to forget about slavery and Jim Crow, shouldn't we be willing to forget about Jefferson Davis?
I don't want anybody to forget anything. I mean, history is history. It's what it was. It simply was. We can't hide from it. We can't avoid it. We need to talk about it. We need to discuss it. On Black Lives Matter, the problem I have with those folks is when I hear people chanting pigs in a blanket from Mike Bacon, what do we want, dead cops, when do we want them now? I got a problem with those people. I got the same problem with those people I have with the Klan and other groups like that. That's based on hate. I've got no use for that, no stomach for
history
that.
Isn't always pretty, and in this case, certainly isn't. So, David, what do we do? Historians don't want history erased. They want it explained, correct, and understood.
Exactly. So there are really three ways to do this. One way is to place the monuments in the museum. I don't think they should be destroyed, because why destroy our history? We need to learn from history.
Otherwise, you're liable to repeat it.
Exactly. we can contextualize it with a statue, with another statue, and that's been done, for example, in Austin, Texas, at the University of Texas. It's also been done on Monument Avenue in Richmond. You have those magnificent equestrian statue of Robert E. Lee. Well, what the city of Richmond did, a majority black city, was erect a statue of Arthur Ashe, the African-American tennis star.
Who was from Richmond.
Who was from Richmond. Yeah. So now Monument Avenue is integrated. The problem with the Confederate monuments is that they tell only part of the story. And it's a part of the story that's skewed incorrectly, in my view, so that it's only half of the story.
President Trump, in his very controversial remarks at the time, reacting to the Charlotte incident, pointed to this move to take down Confederate statues as something that might lead to the removal of statues of George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, because they, too, were slave owners.
Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson? Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. You're changing history. You're changing culture.
What about that? They did own slaves.
Well, this is the slippery slope that some people fear. But who among us sitting here or listening to us is perfect? Nobody. George Washington had many great attributes, as did Thomas Jefferson. The key difference, though, is that they did not take up arms against the government of the United States.
And they lost the war. The South lost the war. And as I said earlier in our conversation, we don't honor folks that finished second.
Is there a place for compromise on this issue? This, like so many other issues in American politics today, has a firm, deep dividing line. How do you reach a compromise?
Well, I can't, when it comes to racism and discrimination and hatred, I'm not sure there is any compromising on that, right? I mean, either it's right, it's wrong. And so there is no compromising on hatred and racism and discrimination. Obviously, we want to respect history. We need to understand history, but we ought not to repeat history. If someone had told me that my sister would have died in 2015 by going to church by white supremacists, I would say that would not be true. If someone said last week you would see basically KKK guys and white Nazis marching in Charlottesville, Virginia, chaining hatred in America, I would say that's not true, but that is our present. And so
is the weight of this on your shoulders and people who believe in the cause that the Civil War was fought over in your mind? Is the weight on you to separate racism from what you treasure?
That's exactly what we strive to do. I don't speak for the Sons of Confederate Veterans. I'm a member. I love the organization. We don't tolerate that. If I've had people trying to join our local camp that had affiliations with the Klan, and we turned them down right on the spot. They will not be in our organization. I agree with Malcolm. Racism, bigotry, hatred, prejudice, it's not to be tolerated, but it's here. Mm-hmm. We do have to tolerate it to some degree, but we don't have to approve of it. We do need to fight against this. We fight against it in the Sons of Confederate Veterans. We don't like it. And a lot of the problems that people have today on their opinions of those Confederate monuments is based on these knuckleheads. And bearing in mind in Charlottesville, a lot of people miss this point. On one side was a bunch of Nazis that were wanting the monument to stay up, and we want the monuments to stay up as well, but for a different reason than they did. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you had these other bunch of knuckleheads that were part of other socialist and communist movements, the Communist Workers' Party and the World Worker Party and stuff like that. Black Lives Matter, we know they're a hate group. Antifa, we
Black
know they're
Lives
a hate
Matters
group.
Is not a hate group.
When you go out there and start chanting,
Black
Lord, we
Lives
want dead
Matter
cops, Lord,
is
want them
not
now. You tell
a
me that's
hate
not
group.
A hate group. What the hell is it?
That cannot be equated with the Nazis and the KKK. That is simply
wrong.
Factually
wrong.
Incorrect.
You are absolutely wrong. You're going to defend an organization that gets out and chants, what do we want dead cops when they want them now? That's
I
not
would,
hate.
I would join.
And you
Black
want to be taken seriously?
Matter. I
there's something seriously wrong with you.
Black Lives Matter. It is not a hate group.
The hell it ain't.
Well, this is emblematic.
How do you chant for somebody's death if you don't?
This is emblematic of what the problem is here with this argument over Confederate memorials. And I think we have a deep misunderstanding of each other. And that's a topic for another show. I'm sorry to say we are out of time. Bill Starnes, camp commander of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, Malcolm Graham, former state senator, and Dr. David Goldfield, professor of history at UNC Charlotte, author of America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation and Still Fighting the Civil War, which is obvious. Thank you all for the hour.